This is the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Most of our discussions on politics, economics, and culture are now also available to watch on our YouTube channel. This week, editor Ian Martin spoke to historian Adam Tooze about his new book, Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. Listen to a part of their conversation here, and the full video is on our YouTube channel.
You've written very successful books about the past and the near past. What was it like writing this about a subject, the pandemic, while it's still ongoing and without actually knowing the ending?
Yeah, it's more intense for sure. There's no question. But anyone who's in the journalism game or in market research or, you know, policy making knows this feeling. And for me, I think it was salutary as a historian who, as you said, you know, spent a lot of my early career studying, I don't know, the Versailles Peace Treaty or policy responses to the Great Depression, in at least a vicarious way, to expose myself to the pressure of having to make real-time gambles, real-time wagers on a particular interpretation. Because, I mean, I have colleagues who are leery of doing contemporary history, and this is super contemporary history. It's really history in real time. But I've come around to the view that every historian ought to do at least one project this way, maybe not a book, but at least an essay. Try and grasp what it means to orientate yourself on a given day, you know, formulate a view which you're going to publish the day after tomorrow, which may be invalidated by what happens the next morning. And that, you know, that sense of exposure is acute. But I was very, you know, it really concentrates the mind.
Yeah. That's a feeling that's familiar to journalists and, you know, people writing columns every time. Yeah. But as you say, I think it's really, really important. And it's a really important book. Now, reminders. What was the initial economic impact of this thing, COVID?
Well, it started in China, and this is too easily sort of forgotten in the West, because we sort of bracket China. But if the clock had stopped at the end of February, in the record of Chinese economic development since the beginning of the reform era in the 80s, late 70s, this would have been by far and away the most severe shock. This has all been subsequently obscured by the, you know, the even larger drama in the rest of the world's economy. But at that moment, we think unemployment in China may have been surging above 20%. Of course, the official records there are very incomplete because they don't count the most vulnerable and exposed workers, who are the migrant workers. But, you know, reasonable reconstruction suggests that there's a huge hit to exactly the same sectors that suffer a hit in the West, the service sector face to face. And China is, it's very important to remember, a middle income country still, and a very large percent of its population. Prime Minister Li Keqiang was talking about 600 million Chinese who still live at very modest levels of income, relying on small trading. They are just as severely hit as the informal sector in any of the big emerging market economies. So this is a huge shock. And then, of course, the global manufacturing sectors, the Foxconns of this world and so on, are shutting down as well. That's where it starts. And it ripples out from there to the economies most directly connected. So in the auto sector, we see huge supply chain problems. The first case of COVID in Bavaria is, in fact, somebody in a parts supplier to the German auto industry. Bangladesh textile sector is hit very hard by the lack of supplies. But it's really in the first and second week of March that the shock spreads west by way of the financial markets. It's a sort of indirect effect at first, with OPEC not being able to agree on how to react to what they anticipate being a demand shock from the Chinese side. And that, I think, gets analysts' alarm bells ringing. And then really it's that week, Monday, March 9th, when the financial markets in the West go and we tumble towards what I call a shutdown. So the collective decision to dial down economic activity, to stop selling, to stop buying, to stop going to work. By early April, you know, we've seen the largest and most dramatic hit ever recorded by economic data. So 20% fall, these are the Goldman Sachs index numbers, 20% fall in global GDP in a matter of weeks. I mean, this is, you know, like nothing we've ever seen before. 3.3 billion people under some sort of restrictive work regime. The entire population of young people around the world essentially furloughed from school and college, 1.6 to 1.7 billion people. These aren't even numbers, frankly, I was aware of. Until the crisis, I didn't know what, you know, what the global workforce was. I mean, you could have taken a, you know, back of the envelope type guess, but the idea that they would in fact all be united in a single regime of restriction, well, not a single, but like a patchwork regime that affected practically everyone was beggar's belief, really.
You describe, in the book, you describe, I think, March the 12th to the 15th as key because of what was happening in the US bond market. Yes. So explain to the layperson not necessarily familiar with the intricacies of financial markets, what's so critical about that dysfunction in the US Treasuries market? You describe it almost really as it's the kind of end of the economic chain, isn't it? When you've got a panic and the US Treasuries market no longer seems viable, well, you're in completely new territory.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of investments as basically being either in private financial assets or in public and financial assets, then the ones that hog the headlines tend to be the equities, right? So the shares in Apple, FANG, you know, the tech stocks or whatever. And those have tracked a kind of obsessive interest. And unsurprisingly, they were selling off in late February, early March. Like, you know, this isn't a real puzzle. And what we would hope for, in a sense, is that people then run towards the safety net, right? That they run to safety. And the place of safety are government debt, and particularly the US government debt. Not because, you know, the American government right now has the best reputation or Congress is a kind of model parliament, but because it's a giant market, now about $21 trillion worth of US Treasury debt in public hands for sale. Mm. And because it's so large and because all of the most sophisticated players are there with the biggest balance sheets, the crucial thing about that market is that on any given day under normal circumstances, you can be confident of being able to sell however many treasuries you like at whatever the going price is. There's no haggling, right? There's no sense in which your decision to do something has any effect on the environment. So you can just optimize. It's a parameter. You can take it as a given what's happening outside your world. And that makes it crucial for all of the calculations of portfolio maximization and so on, because you have the riskier, less liquid end of your portfolio where you aim to make the profits. And you then keep a piggy bank of cash or near cash equivalents, and the most obvious near cash equivalent is treasuries. And the terrifying thing that started to happen in that second week of March is that the treasury market started to malfunction. It did it in two ways. First of all, people were selling them rather than buying them, which came as a real shock, because in recent decades, whenever equities have sold off, people have piled into treasuries. That's not a law of nature, but it's been a regularity.
It's a rush to safety.
Rush to safety, but this time straight through treasuries, out the other side into cash. So, you know, cash. I mean, literally, because when we talk about the dominance of the dollar in the world's economy, what we actually mean is the dominance of the treasury normally. But this was literally people wanting cash in, you know, current account, bank accounts. And then the market stopped working. So it isn't just that the prices were going down when we would normally hope they'd go up. The effect of them going up is that interest rates fall. So that's really good news for the economy in a moment of panic. So what we actually saw was prices going down. So interest rates were going up, compounding the pressure on the corporates. And then the terrifying thing, the truly mind-blowing thing, is you couldn't transact. So you couldn't actually sell billions of dollars of treasuries in a matter of minutes as you normally can for a going price. You had to haggle. Sometimes you couldn't transact at all. It could take hours to complete major trades, even with very, very major players in this market. And this is the market where the truly big actors play. The balance sheets involved are the balance sheets of the likes of JP Morgan, which is generally reckoned to be the key player in this system. And that is the most disturbing thing imaginable, because at that moment, you look essentially at your portfolio and go, you know, none of this makes sense. If I can't turn my treasuries into cash, then really the rest of what I'm holding is not sustainable. And all of the prices for everything else were falling too. So if you tried to liquidate any of the rest of your portfolio, you were doing that into, you weren't just unleashing a firestorm or a fire sale, you were doing it into a fire sale. So it was a truly toxic situation, unlike anything we saw even in 2008. And you can really tell how seriously they took it by the scale of the intervention. I mean, what the Fed was doing by the end of March is like nothing we've ever seen before. $1 million a second in asset purchases, yeah. $70 to $80 billion a day, 5% of this huge market in a matter of weeks taken onto the balance sheet of the Fed. So a huge disturbance. And the paradox of it, a bit like, you know, people say about the pandemic itself, if you succeed, no one knows it's there. And because they succeeded in stabilizing this, by April, you know, there were plenty of other things to be worrying about. So it disappears out of the headlines. But I think in retrospect, it's quite clear for everyone in finance that that's the truly terrifying thing we saw, because that really mustn't happen.
Yeah, I remember a friend who lives and works in the markets, and this is his world, being completely terrified, and then, as you say, a few weeks later, trying to act cool and saying, well, it was always going to be sorted out, but it wasn't necessarily predetermined. But to what extent did the political environment in those first few weeks in March, what was going on in Washington, help fuel the panic, do you think?
I think it's quite complicated because, you know, a lot of us for a long time, you know, centrist liberals had been sort of racking our brains and scratching our heads and frankly really worried about the combination of a financial crisis with Trump in the White House and the Republicans on the, you know, warpath in Congress. That didn't look like a good combination. And you could say in that second week of March, so March 11th is that's the Wednesday, is the day that Trump just sort of goes on television and says, okay, you know, no Europeans can travel to the US anymore. Except the Irish and the Brits for reasons no one can figure out. You have tens of thousands of Americans running to the airports enacting their own kind of Saigon evacuation from Charles de Gaulle. I mean, it's all a bit crazy. You know, Tom Hanks declares he's got it in Australia. So like even everyone's like, you know, favorite uncle is suddenly ill with the disease. It did look as though the kind of world was coming apart. That was a bad moment. That was one of the really bad moments. But in general, the way this has played out is rather contrary to expectations. I think, you know, sort of liberal centrists have to sort of check their prejudices at this point, because our assumption was nationalism, xenophobia, perhaps just a sort of flat earth mentality would be a disaster. And in fact, of course, it turns out that President Trump, if there was ever a president who took easily to the, you know, the idea of fiat money, in other words, money was what the government said money was, you know, it was Donald Trump. So long as his name was on the checks, like it was all good with him, the bigger the better. The only thing he ever bullied the Fed about, it's worth remembering, is them not actually acting proactively enough, not doing enough stimulus. And he was brutal and extraordinary in his attacks. And then having a man like him in the White House, in turn, as it were, defused any possible attacks that we might have had from fiscal and monetary hawks, such as they are, in the Republican Party in Congress, because they weren't exactly going to go and attack their own president. So in some ways, it turned out, you know, not to be the worst of all worlds. And even when it came to global support actions by the Fed, you know, not nary a word, rather on the contrary. You know, this was anything that was good for the S&P 500 was fine with him. When it came to the IMF and things like special drawing rights for low-income countries in the developing world, different story. The Treasury put its foot down, and we haven't got those until the end of the summer, a year later. But that's where, you know, real politics, so because Venezuela and Iran would have been in line to get those, that the Republicans weren't going to do that. But on the whole, it was a more concerted response than many of us anticipated, I think.
And he had gone, I mean, it's an interesting contradiction, isn't it? He had gone from in February really just wanting to pretend that it wasn't happening, you know, it goes away, all of that stuff, all of that rhetoric, because only one thing mattered, which was the election cycle, this was going to disrupt the US economy. But once he seems to realize belatedly, you're right, he switches into wanting as much activism as possible, presumably just to keep the show on the road. What about what governments then do across the West? It's not just the West, but particularly in the West, where there's the firepower. And governments act in a way that would have been regarded as unthinkable before the crisis. Describe the scale of it, and were you surprised that governments did it?
Yeah, so the really interesting thing and the truly novel thing is that we see, you know, something tantamount to a coordination of fiscal and monetary policy here. They won't say that out loud because that really would be to cross a kind of line, because, you know, the idea of central bank independence is very important. But de facto, this huge expansionary action by the central banks buying government debt created an environment in which it was easy for governments to act and do fiscal policy. And that has taken on dimensions, you know, that the CARES Act program in the United States, several trillion dollars at a time, and an extraordinary array of guarantees of support checks in Europe, including the UK, you know, this new innovation really in the welfare state, which amounted to furloughing people from work but keeping them on their employers' books and with the public purse covering the difference. So sort of short-time working, a model that the Germans had pioneered in 2008-09 and worked extremely well for them. becomes commonplace, exported to Australia as well. Canada uses it to a degree. So we are seeing a kind of comprehensive embrace of the responsibility of elected governments, in fact, not just elected, but governments around the world, for how handling this crisis, allowing people to get through it. I think this has got a lot to do with the fact that this isn't a 2008-09 crisis, right? At least in the short term, it was. You couldn't point the finger at anyone and say, look, you're to blame for your own downfall. You should be responsible, therefore, for the consequences. That whole moral hazard argument just didn't bite. And instead, what we were asking people to do for the good of society as a whole is to limit their external contact. We all know the logics. And so, in a sense, it was crucial for governments to step in. And it turned out to be possible for them to do so. Right? It didn't produce. You would have thought sort of kitchen sink economics would tell you, you borrow as much as anyone's borrowed since World War II. You should expect interest rates to go up, right? Because there's a stock of savings and you're taking more of them out. And so they get more expensive. So the interest rate goes up. Didn't happen. On the contrary, interest rates fall. So there isn't even a precautionary reason not to do this. In fact, rather the opposite. Like the situation demanded action and there wasn't a good financial reason for not acting. Should be said, however, that we won't really know what lessons were learned, I would argue, till next year. Because if the analogue is to 2008, it wasn't till 2010 that austerity was adopted. That means 2022 is going to be the crunch year. And frankly, it is shaping up to be precisely that.
And do you think on that, do you think governments have a plan, or are they really just watching and waiting to see whether there's another, you know, twist in the tail, another plot twist in terms of how the epidemic or pandemic develops?
I mean, I'd like to think there was a plan. I don't think so. I think it's pretty much makeshift right now, and the course of Delta and possible subsequent variants is just too uncertain. I mean, I do find it horrifying that there isn't a more proactive mobilization with regards to the variant risk. I mean, the reason for rolling out a massive global vaccination program to reach the other half of the world's population that has not been vaccinated yet is not charity. And it's not even the economic, you know, benefit from restoring economic growth. The obvious reason for doing it is to massively reduce the chances of some variant much worse than Delta, which tips us into scenarios we can't even calculate. We can calculate what the benefits are of a recovery next year, and they're in the order of $8 to $10 trillion. So you'd think that would be enough incentive. But the real question is, if we don't do this and we incubate a new variant that is worse than Delta, perhaps much more lethal, it's hard to see how it could be more infectious. And that tips us into, you know, in 2022, into the sort of place we were in spring 2020. I mean, like, why are we even hesitating? The amounts of money at stake here in terms of global impact are just. And nevertheless, you couldn't really say that the G20 or the G7 have, with real energy, kind of on a daily reporting basis, is how many hundred millions of people we did today. Yes, you will be able to make confident plans for the summer of 2022. That's what this is about. This isn't some long-term climate change thing where we're talking about the future of our grandchildren. This is literally whether or not we can confidently plan a return to something like normality next year.
Now, the news cycle this week has been dominated by a discussion of rising fuel prices. Maggie Pagano spoke to Simon French, chief economist at Panmure Gordon, about why government policy has led to such an inefficient market.
Now, I came across an article, Simon, that you wrote in April 2017. Great headline, by the way, great line. Caps, control and lock belong on a keyboard and not in the economy. And you predicted that putting an energy cap on prices would be potentially disaster. Can you explain your thinking and then tell us what you think is really happening at the moment?
Absolutely. And good evening, Maggie. And first of all, thank you for having me on this section. It's a delight to talk to you. The article that I did 4 years ago, I hope, acknowledged that there has become a sense within government that it can predict with certainty economic variables going forward, be it inflation, be it the gas price. And by putting in caps or locks or constraints, you know, automatic ways in which you deliver either controls on prices or uplifts in prices or indeed awards or benefits, then you risk, and this is the real heart of it, you risk those really powerful mechanisms of prices that you have in a capitalist system that decide how households make consumption decisions and how businesses invest, you risk neutering those. And those are such powerful allocative signals, important for our efficiency, important for our productivity, that I thought it was misguided. And I think 4 years on, that column has aged pretty well.
I think so. Not many can say that. So we have crisis talks at the moment. The business minister, Kwasi Kwarteng, has said that, well, he's indicated that he might well bail out a lot of the suppliers who came into the market after when those energy caps came in. Now, do we think it is right that the taxpayers should be bailing them out? Because in a sense, you could argue that their business model, they weren't obviously hedging enough, they can't afford it, they don't have the capital to do so. Actually, it proves your point, doesn't it, that the market was not an efficient allocator. So what do you think would be the correct direction now?
Well, to steal someone else's quote, I wouldn't have started from here. And that is, unfortunately, the position that Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng finds himself in. And I actually have a lot of time for Mr. Kwarteng, but unfortunately, the misguided policies leads to a situation where it is inconceivable that we can have service withdrawn of such a core utility as energy, particularly over the winter months, indeed in any month. But I think it's crucial here that what comes out of this period, because it's inevitable that the Exchequer will be on the hook in terms of supporting energy companies, that we have a real understanding of what an optimal market in an area that is so fundamental to people's lives, it's a core utility function, what that looks like. It's absolutely the correct thing to try and encourage competition between suppliers. It's absolutely the right thing to try and avoid supernormal profits that is so easy in an oligopoly or a monopoly model. But unfortunately, if it is heads you win, tails we lose, that is unfortunately not a good way to try and introduce market forces into what is a natural oligopoly or monopoly model.
So if we go back in time, the reason that this cap came about was because of widespread fears and belief that the big six, as we used to call them, Centrica, RWE and the others, were in fact profiteering, despite actually, if you looked at their accounts, the margins were very thin. So are we saying that actually they weren't profiteering and that there was a misconception about how the market worked? And if that is the case, should we allow, if you like, those big six to reemerge?
I'll give you a straight answer to a straight question. Yes, I think it was a misdiagnosis. I think that was the wrong way of looking at the market. The market failure here in economic terms was that consumers were failing to shop around and taking advantage of the fact that there were available prices, better prices than the standard variable tariff on most of these energy companies. And the government, perhaps to its credit, some years ago, wanted to encourage consumers to be more savvy, to shop around. But a startling stat that I came across from Ofgem, the regulator, is that 60% of UK households are still on their standard variable tariff. They've never changed their energy provider. And therefore, as a result, consumers have made the decision to vote with their feet, or indeed not vote, you know, not use their feet to vote and move their custom elsewhere. And the problem, of course, with an energy price cap is rather than trying to encourage that through the price mechanism, because of course, if you reach a pressure point, you want consumers to respond to that price signal and shop around, you're actually doing quite the opposite of what you want to do, which is to energize and activate the consumer to stop the big six or whatever suppliers from creating monopoly profits. You're going in exactly the opposite direction if you want to have consumers making savvy financial decisions.
How could you improve that? Because I have to say, when I've looked myself, when we've looked as a household at sort of swapping around and different tariffs, I mean, it's just so complicated that I'm afraid I'm clearly not one of your savvy customers. You know, it's one of those things that goes the back of the pile, doesn't it? And you think, well, maybe an extra X or Y, but to a lot of people that does matter. So is there anything they could do to improve that?
Well, there's the risk of being the answer always being technology. There are a kind of intermediaries coming into the marketplace who take control of your energy bills. You share your data with them. You instruct them. You enter an intermediary contract for that intermediary function to shop around on your behalf. So if you don't want to do it, you can employ an intermediary in order to ensure that every 12 months, every 18 months, every 2 years, at what point your renewal is, that they come in and use their market intelligence to navigate what absolutely is a bit of a minefield in terms of understanding the myriad of tariffs out there. So given that both commercial enterprises, mm-hmm. intermediaries can come in and do that, and in so doing, free up time for other people, for people who don't want to do it, to pursue other interests that in economic terms they gain more utility from. That for me is a healthy market-based model.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Kwarteng has said or promised that he wouldn't actually lift the energy cap. And yet at the same time, they would keep an energy cap. And yet at the same time, they said it will probably go up to 1,277 this autumn and then possibly 1,500 next spring. Now, isn't that yet another sort of artificial barrier? It seems rather bizarre. How can they anticipate what it's going to be next spring anyway? Doesn't it, in a sense, make it even more of a nonsense of the idea of having this cap?
It does, and particularly that would look a very odd commitment if the wholesale gas price, if the wind starts blowing in the United Kingdom, some of the supply tanker shortages, supply routes, start to provide more and the wholesale price comes down. Some of the assessment I did when the energy price cap came out, the latest one on the 6th of August this year, is Ofgem revealed that already the 42% increase year on year in wholesale gas added about £155 to the average dual fuel tariff versus last year. But if you took the spot price over the last 7 days and fed that into Ofgem's formula, £155 would now be north of £900 additional on a typical household's utility bill. That is a 6x increase over the course of just more than 6 weeks. So for Mr. Kwarteng to have any idea on what it looks like in 6 weeks, 6 months' time, I think is overstretching both his forecasting ability and indeed the forecasting ability of anybody who operates in what is a globalised energy market.
Absolutely. And on that point, whilst we're obviously all here concentrating on the UK market, of course, these wholesale prices have been going up right across Europe and indeed even in the US, I think over the last year, 280% across EU countries. I certainly know the Spanish, the Italians have been whacking up their bills as well. But is our situation worse here? Has it been worsened by the cap?
I wouldn't say it was worsened by the cap insofar as from a consumer's perspective. And my criticism of this is not the sort of consumer utility, again, to use the jargon that British consumers have garnered from all of this, but it is the second order effects that really concerns me in terms of the stability and the efficiency of the marketplace. What higher prices, those numbers you mentioned from both the US and Europe, and indeed from the UK, be it generated as a result of regulation in the form of green taxes associated to try and incentivize households to shift, is by not passing those impacts on in full by introducing a price cap, you have discouraged households to go and A, use less electricity, B, update their technology, their energy usage to more efficient sources. And of course, microgeneration solutions, solar panels, air source heat pumps, while many people will rightly say the economics of those don't stack up. Of course, with the higher wholesale price, the economics of that investment do start to stack up. And therefore, the very energy transition that I suspect Boris Johnson in New York will talk about, he'll talk about again at COP26, is actually paradoxically uncomfortable for a lot of people, but will be encouraged, reinforced, incentivized by higher prices, because that is the market sending healthy signals on what households and businesses need to do.
So, Simon, if you had one piece of advice for the business minister and the industry? What reforms would you like to see introduced? What can they do to get out of this rather tricky situation?
Well, near term, unfortunately, there is a political imperative, a social imperative for continuity of supply and not to introduce a shock where people who had previous capped utility bills with a provider that potentially goes bust and they move to another supplier don't have a particular uplift. Unfortunately, general taxation, the Exchequer, Treasury are going to have to dip into their pockets in order to ensure both that continuity of service and less of a shock to household incomes. But then going forward, and as with all good public policy, I'm afraid the boring answer is this will take many, many years in order to instigate, is reintroduce the price signals that the free market entails. Now, if you are worried about operators in that market generating supernormal profits, then have a competition and markets authority with the teeth that the previous head of the CMA, Andrew Tyrie, wanted to introduce, but ultimately had been neutered at many turns. I think there is a big role here if you want to regulate what is traditionally a utility-style model, to do it through that mechanism rather than blunt price mechanisms which have those really damaging second-order effects.
Absolutely. Final question, Simon, and I'll leave you. Have we been too hasty in the UK to try and cut carbon emissions 80% or now 100% by 2050 and to switch over to renewables? I was looking at the BM reports live data feed on the national grid today, and 47% of all electricity supplies came from gas. I think it was 16% from biomass and wind and about 10 from solar. So, I mean, we know that the wind has been exceptionally low, but, you know, our reliance on foreign imports, our cutting of coal, which, you know, obviously was the right thing to do over time. But have we been too eager to do this without looking at overall supplies going forward?
This is to some extent a subjective judgment, but I would say no, we haven't been too eager. But I will buttress it by something which is a bit more objective, which is to say, to be intellectually coherent with our conversation of the last 10 minutes, I think it's really important that governments, regulators send out consistent signals to the market in order for them to plan. It doesn't matter whether it's on the capacity side or in terms of households for upgrading their technology. And therefore, I'm comfortable personally with a target that is 29 years away, that gives a lead-in time for capital in the private sector, capital in the household sector, to respond and make those transitions over that timescale. I don't see that as a particularly overambitious or putting it as at a disadvantage. While the pain near term for households may be higher bills, longer term, and there are plenty of very reputable reports here, if the UK develops, becomes a, dare I say it, a global leader, but certainly a supplier of relevance in the green economy, that generates jobs, that generates incomes that support both productivity and ultimately the ability to pay those energy bills going forward. It's a circular economy here. And I personally think that, that those kind of market signals are quite important, quite valuable, not a time that I'm personally uncomfortable with.
And now, here is the sixth episode of our new show, Press Review. Ian, Maggie and Tim Montgomery chose the stories in the media that grabbed them. From the AUKUS Defence Pact to Kemi Badenoch, and from the Canadian election to the nature of capitalism. Here is the whole show.
First choice, Maggie, kick us off with your very interesting take on a story that you've spotted, which reveals a lot about what I think is probably the biggest story in the world at the moment.
Yeah, it is. And we've obviously had President Macron having his hissy fit over the AUKUS deal between Britain and Australia. And there was a lot of talk that actually the French knew that that submarine contract was going to go. And then the story I have spotted, thanks to somebody tweeting it, who I can't remember, but a defence specialist. And the story is dated January the 19th this year. It's by somebody called Thomas Newdick of The Drive, which is an online American defense specialist magazine. And he says, this is January, remember, so 8 months before this contract unrolled, that the Australian Financial Review had reported in depth that the Australian government was in talks with the naval group because they were deeply unhappy with the way the contract was going. And it was a very well-sourced story. Talks about the fact that apparently 60% of the work for the submarines was meant to have been given out to all local suppliers in Australia. The naval group apparently weren't doing this. There was even talk in this story that the Australian Defence Minister was having talks with Saab about an alternative because they were so unhappy. And there were other issues, but the intellectual knowledge was being kept in France and not transferred to Australia. So the idea that the French French can say that they were surprised by this, they may have been surprised by the announcement of AUKUS, but they can't have really, from what one is seeing, be surprised that the deal, you know, was going to be changed.
Yeah. Or whatever. No. It is an illuminating report, because in the days after the announcement, there was a lot of, you know, speculation about how on earth could French intelligence have missed this. And you're absolutely right, Maggie. They may have missed the surprise announcement from Biden, Boris, and from the Australian Premier. But the signs were there, and actually written down and reported that the arrangement with the French was in serious doubt miles out. It's such an interesting story, this, which spans the globe, and it's good to see. It's a kind of story where we have to tap into sources from Australia, from the US, and tap into what the French press are doing as well. Closer to home, one of my picks, though, is a piece by Jeremy Cliff in the New Statesman. I know we keep mentioning the New Statesman probably too much on this show, but we'll avoid the New Statesman next week. But it's by Jeremy Cliff, I think he's their international affairs editor or assistant editor, of course, ex-economist, on the profound implications of the deal. And it's his latest piece of the New Statesman, essentially says, well, you have to see this in terms of nuclear proliferation in the Pacific. I don't necessarily agree with him, but he's right about the increased risk that in the Indo-Pacific, there's going to be more of a focus on nuclear-powered submarines, nuclear weapons as well, and that this creates the potential not only for a Cold War but for a hot war. Tim, what have you made of the story this week? And I described it earlier as the biggest story in the world at the moment. I know there's lots of other interesting stuff happening, but it does portend a big geopolitical shift, doesn't it?
Mm. It's been interesting. I listened to American podcasts, probably too many American podcasts, and actually they have been very focused on this issue. Normally the American podcasts I listen to, political podcasts, are very domestic orientated. It's rare that they're really shifted onto something like this. The overwhelming consensus is that France has behaved badly, but the relationship with France needs to be repaired. And interestingly, and I don't think this is just because it's something that I listen out for, I think it's genuine, it's been interesting to hear commentators from across the American spectrum note that perhaps because Britain is out of the European Union, Britain has more flexibility to do arrangements like this. And they see it in some way as Britain coming of Brexit age, if you like. And so it's been interesting for the Biden administration, which of course is quite sceptical about Brexit, to have really given Britain this this opportunity that it hasn't been willing to give to France. Now, perhaps that's just motivated by the commercial demands of the submarine contract, but the results are in, and Biden has done a deal with Britain outside of the European Union, not France inside the European Union, and that hasn't failed to hit the notice of American foreign policy makers.
And it was funny this week, wasn't it, the way in which one particular comment from Boris Johnson, donnez-moi un break, or whatever it was, speaking in Franglais, telling the French to get a grip when he was in the US this week, drove and you see this on social media time and time again, and in some of the reporting across parts of the British press who still haven't sort of figured out Boris Johnson, drives them completely mad. Whereas it's clearly a deliberate strategy. He's slightly trolling President Macron, but also saying something, as he did at the UN with his Kermit remark, which is designed to grab attention. And his critics still can't see that this is a very clever technique. So Twitter went into meltdown this week over Boris Johnson comments, but still his supporters really like it. Tim, I'm going to ask you for your next choice. We move on to another podcast, I think. Yep. And this time different part of North America.
Well, you say that everyone is talking about the submarine deal. Of course, everyone is not talking about the other big event in the world, which is the Canadian election results. I remember, I think 10 or so years ago, Ian, we were at a Tory conference, and I was trying to get you interested in Stephen Harper. I think you were there with Fraser Nelson, and I couldn't get you excited about what I thought was incredibly important going on in Ottawa. Well, I think I've given up largely trying to get people interested in Canadian elections. And even the Canadians this time aren't that interested in their election. This was an election that wasn't necessary. Justin Trudeau called because he thought he would win a majority. In a lackluster campaign, he failed to win a majority. He actually got elected re-elected as Canadian Prime Minister with just 32% of the vote. It's the lowest that a Prime Minister has ever got in Canadian history. It's because they have a first-past-the-post system with candidates split right across the political spectrum. But it just sort of underlines for me how hard it is for a Conservative to get elected in Canada. The Canadian Conservatives got about 1.5 percentage points more than than Trudeau, but their vote is sort of, is all accumulated in sort of the west of Canada and in rural Canada, and whereas the Liberal Party's vote, Trudeau's party's vote, is well sort of well spread throughout the urban areas, and the Tory candidate for Prime Minister Erin O'Toole, he moved to the centre, he embraced lots of sort of mainstream Canadian opinions, which, as you know, Canada's a very liberal country. That seemed to increase his support in key battlegrounds on Ontario. But he's now got this populist party that scored just over 5%, now, nipping at the Conservative heels. So it's for those who are interested in politics, it's a fascinating story of an election that was fought. But I think probably you can make a case that being conservative leader in Canada is about the hardest job for any conservative in the world. And Erin O'Toole, unfortunately, cheered on, I think, by most of the conservative world, fell short on this occasion.
And for people who want to tune into the podcast to hear more, what was the podcast that you wanted to highlight, Tim?
So it's called CPAC Politics Today, and it is a daily podcast. It's what happens is you get the anchor interviews a Canadian journalist, and so those of us who are interested in Canadian politics, we can get a 15-minute fix each day. And this one was interviewing John Iverson, who is a columnist for the National Post magazine, really good commentator. But they'll interview a sort of conservative-minded commentator one day, a liberal-minded commentator the next day. And it really is, I find, it's the best way of keeping up with Canadian politics, should that be your delight.
Yeah. John Iverson, an old colleague and friend of mine from Scotland, and we worked together on Scotland on Sunday. Ah. And then he moved across to Canada, and as you say, has become one of the leading...
Probably the premier one, I think.
The leading.
Just in case he's watching.
But he's a fantastic writer and talker about politics, and just has a really nice, you know, sort of finely honed blend of just enough cynicism or skepticism, and also enthusiasm for the political beat. I actually would say that you're right, Tim. I do find you were right more than 10 years ago. Canada is interesting for the reason that you mentioned. If Conservatives can't take power there, having shifted to the centre and done everything which they were supposed to do, and it still leaves Trudeau in power, that's just something revealing about the state of mainstream conservatism. You were going to say, Tim?
Yeah, so just one footnote, which is a little bit of interest, I think, is that where the Canadian Conservatives did make gains was in Atlantic Canada, in working class areas, and they specifically tailored some of their policies for sort of working class Canadians. And so it's yet another Anglosphere country now. We know about Britain and the Red Wall. We know about Australia, the Queensland-Sydney trade-off. We know about America, where Trump did well in Pennsylvania and Michigan, etc. Now we have Canada as well. This isn't just a Brexit effect. This is a global effect where upscale, university-educated voters are moving to the left, and downscale voters who are struggling with some of the economic challenges of our time are moving right. And I think Canada's election is confirmation of that, if we needed it.
Yeah. And I mean, it may be, of course, that politics post-financial crisis is moving, has moved to the left, that's one of the big shifts. Definitely. And that actually the Conservative Party in Britain has spotted that, or instinctively gone where the votes are, which might explain why you have a sort of high tax big state model under Boris Johnson. But on that note, related, Maggie, your next choice is from CapEx, which is a website I'm very, very fond of, having been involved in the establishment of it back in 2014. And your pick is on a survey about capitalism.
Yeah, the article is by Rebecca Ray, and the headline is "Young People Aren't Left-Wing, They Just Don't Understand Capitalism." And she's based it on a recent survey carried out by the Institute of Economic Affairs that found a quarter of people under 22 mistook the definition of socialism and capitalism. And she, it's a really good piece, because what she's saying is that most people are intuitively capitalist, but that the conservatives are not really very good at explaining it. And that rather than sort of putting so much concentration on leveling up and so forth, what the government should be doing is actually just saying, we want to make everybody wealthier, higher productivity, higher wages, and so forth. Now, I think there's a little wrinkle in this argument, which is that all capitalism is not naked. Corporate capitalism is not good. And where conservatives allow themselves to be criticized is that they're not critical enough when capitalism goes bad. So when you have big oligopolies, monopolies, whether it's in, you know, housing, we talked about it before. But the main point was, and it was a good one, is that young people are not intuitively to the left, despite what George Bernard Shaw said. And most people today want to be their own entrepreneur and set up their own businesses, which you can't get much more sort of naked business minded than that. So it's a good provocative piece.
But there is a problem, isn't there, in that capitalists, and there is a debate among people who believe in markets, whether that's the right word to use, whether it's an unattractive word or whether it's an insult. I mean, I've tended to take the view post-financial crisis that opponents of markets are going to use that term anyway, so might as well, if not embrace it, might as well use it. And the difficulty, I think, is that capitalists have not really been able to, and it is a good piece, but I think it maybe doesn't quite address the nub of the problem, which is that capitalists can't quite, or pro-market folk, can't quite decide which position to adopt. Is it that what happened in the financial crisis was the cause of, was the court was triggered by big government interfering in the housing market in the US and excessively large banks. So does capitalism need reform, or is capitalism fantastic in its current format and just needs defending? And certainly the thing that always worried me was the misunderstanding around the sort of profit motive, and that large numbers of people don't quite understand what, and all the polling, you know, bears this out, what profit is for, and that profit then is recycled into the economy. It's what fuels people's pensions and pension funds, and it's somehow profit, the profit motive being seen as a bad thing. But we're now more than 10 years, a dozen years since the financial crisis, even more now actually, and still capitalists are discussing this. I mean, Tim, you and I have talked about this for years. How do you make the case?
I think it's difficult. And you know, one of my big conclusions from this is that, you know, even at the height of Mrs. Thatcher's popularity, most of the things that she was doing, such as privatization of some of the utilities, lowering marginal tax rates on higher earners, were very unpopular. I think what we have to realize with capitalism is that I think capitalism's, the fruits of free market economics are very popular, but actually the policies that are put in place to deliver those fruits aren't. And so I'm fundamentally a conservative rather than a capitalist. And I think as part of a wider conservative program, where that conservative program includes tough approaches to crime and law and order, you know, patriotism, etc., you can sell the policy means to capitalism and hope that the fruits are produced sooner rather than later. Yes, of course, the work of organizations like the IEA is incredibly important in creating at least an intellectual climate friendly for capitalism. But converting the public to something which is so counterintuitive that effectively, you know, as Adam Smith set out all those years ago, that self, you know, the rewarding self-interest benefits everyone. It's so much harder for people to grasp onto the moral acceptability of that than communism, which, despite the fact it keeps failing, people intuitively warm to. And so I think we just have to embed capitalism in a wider program and hope that the politics catches up with the fruits of the growth that capitalist economies produce. But I think we have to be more alert as friends of free market systems to the need to be free and competitive. There's far too much concentration of power in far too many markets at the moment. That in that, at least in that sense, is where Elizabeth Warren is right. So there is work to do by capitalists in remembering what our fundamentals are.
And they should be brave and stand up and admit that it's flawed. You know, I mean, like America in the 1920s, Roosevelt, they accepted that these great big monopolies were destroying business and so forth. And they, you know, they reformed them. And I think we need a similar impetus. And I agree with you. Elizabeth Warren has been spot on this.
I'm going to disagree. Well, Elizabeth Warren, yeah, maybe some of the things she said about tech are, you know, in theory attractive, but I think she I would count her as an enemy of free markets and
usually that's true, yeah. But you know, just in this one area, I think she's right.
Yeah, it was just on monopolies that we were talking about.
Yeah, it's things like CapEx and the IEA, and of course we write about this on Reaction, are, you know, making the case for a free market or for a markets driven approach, but. I suppose the positive thing, though, Maggie, as you mentioned it earlier, is that there is enthusiasm for entrepreneurialism. But I think, in a way, it's not surprising that people are somewhat confused about all of this, because it's difficult to work out what this government, in speaking of Britain now, where it actually stands on all of this. And it's very difficult for business or for entrepreneurs or investors to get a clear line of sight. The government is very erratic, isn't it? It's very interventionist, quite populist instincts, driven by headlines and crises. I mean, we haven't mentioned yet the energy you know, the energy stuff. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that next week with some more story picks. But it's difficult as a pro market person, to actually say with any conviction that this government in Britain is pro market itself.
No, it's very tricky. And actually, on the energy market, you could argue that one of the reasons we've got the problem with the price cap is that they didn't allow these young new suppliers in the market, didn't hedge forward. They didn't actually use the financial markets. It's sort of quite ironic. They allowed competition, but the energy suppliers themselves didn't use the mechanism by which they could buy forward and price their products. That's been part of the problem.
Yeah. I think shall we move on to the next story then, which my pick is, I'm going to pick a story from the Daily Mail, though all papers covered it in different ways, including the Times and the Guardian went big on it as well. But the story originally comes from Vice, the, how would you describe it? The left-wing online outlet, or increasingly left-wing online outlet, who broke a story about Kemi Badenoch, the equalities minister in the British government. And the Mail story, furious row over leaked WhatsApp messages from equalities minister Kemi Badenoch saying she doesn't care about colonialism in Africa because it was only old elites who lost out. What I thought was fascinating about the story is, it was leaked from a very modern story. It was Kemi Badenoch talking in a WhatsApp group to fellow conservatives about this subject, then leaked, presumably I think it's made clear in the story who it's leaked by someone who would regard themselves as a conservative, but then to Vice, and the way in which this blew up, and the way in which Badenoch was then attacked, I found really quite concerning in terms of free speech. She was talking privately, but she was also expressing quite a complex, sophisticated set of ideas about these subjects, but has found herself, you know, attacked in very crude terms. Apologies demanded, and it says something about the kind of gotcha attitude on the left, which I think reveals that they do fear politicians like Kemi Badenoch, and as one of her friends said, it's because she's regarded, because she's a conservative, she's regarded as the wrong sort of Nigerian, as one of her friends put it. Tim, what did you make of it?
I agree with absolutely everything you've just said. And I think, you know, it is absolutely striking. We are 1 week after the reshuffle. I think when we last recorded, it was still being completed. But, you know, the diversity of this Tory cabinet, at least according to the left's criteria, is extraordinary. You know, you have two women at the top of the holding offices of the traditionally the three great offices of state. You have Priti Patel and Rishi Sunak holding two of them. You have Nadeem Zahawi and Sajid Javid holding the two positions, health and education, which are probably the frontline public service ministries. And then right down all the way across government. Kwasi Kwarteng, of course, has been across the news all this week as the business secretary, handling perhaps the thorniest challenge for the government at the moment. Nadine Dorries at Culture, one of the biggest briefs in government in so many ways. I think it just completely discombobulates the left. This is supposed to be what they delivered. They are the people who are focused on, you know, bringing women and ethnic minorities into government. And yet the Conservatives have succeeded beyond their own abilities. And I think they hate it, really. And they strike out at someone like Kemi Badenoch because they hate the success that the Tories have had in this field.
Also, Tom Holland, the historian, made the very good point in response to this story in Vice, made the observation that, of course, the decolonization movement in places like Britain is, of course, in and of itself, it's part of a kind of white savior, complex, attempting to impose a very kind of, British or American idea of sorting out Africa. I thought it's so interesting. Just quote the original comments from Kemi Badenoch, and they're taken from WhatsApp chat on Conservative Friends of Nigeria group. She said, "I don't care about colonialism because I know what we were doing before colonialism got there. They came in and just made a different bunch of winners and losers. There was never any concept of rights, so people who lost out were old elites, not everyday people." Now, I mean, it's, you can agree with that, or you can disagree with it, but it is a fair argument. But we now seem to live in a social media climate where it's even, she's committed a sin of political incorrectness by, as a young, young Black Briton of Nigerian, with Nigerian heritage, saying something which doesn't fit with the consensus. And so it's almost as though she's supposed to comply rather than have her own intelligent view. Maggie, what did you make of it? Because she also said something rather rude, which we won't quote on here, about Sam Gyimah, who was a Conservative colleague, and because this is a family show, we certainly won't quote it. But she was asked whether Sam Gyimah could be Tory leader, and I think she said no, with a swear word attached.
Flip no.
But I mean, of course, she turned out to be right in that sense, in that Sam Gyimah did then leave the Tory Party over Brexit and join the Lib Dems.
But it's awful, isn't it, that anyone should think that's even a story? Because if they'd asked her whether, I don't know, who, Nadine Dorries was going to be leader of the party, and she said no, no one would sort of see anything wrong in that. But the fact that he was a fellow Nigerian, it was sort of verboten. But can I go back to, I think, the most interesting and really distressing point about this story is that Kemi raised a really interesting, fascinating idea, which is that the previous elites running Nigeria what she was implying, tribal, authoritarian, riches, they used to kill each other, there were constant warfare. And so the fact that she couldn't even make that comment, and that people wouldn't find that interesting to discuss. I mean, that's the sort of thing you have at A level, isn't it? What were the causes of, why? And we used to be able to debate these ideas. Now, everything is just shut down. The second point, and I'll be really, really brief, is...
That's such a good point, though. We've lost our curiosity. Yeah. We're too embedded in positions. Oh, yeah.
It's like the enlightenment never happened, people used to embrace, particularly British education, is that we were able to be imaginative, creative, and probe, rather than the Napoleonic European that you learn things by rote, or the Japanese approach. People came here because they loved this openness. But the second point is when she talked about property rights. Now, one of the greatest problems of, if you like, the story of Africa and development is that the local people did not have property rights. Yeah, I don't know if you come across the economist Hernando de Soto. Mm-hmm. It's his big thing. And it's one of the reasons why the Chinese have been able to go in and buy up so much land with the connivance of the local governments, because they have basically just taken this land, which has been owned by them, for hundreds and hundreds of years, but they don't have anything written down, or haven't done until recently. And so her point about property rights, again, why aren't people saying, oh, how interesting, Kemi, will you tell us more about this? Let's hear your view. It's so left field that we would like to hear it.
Instead, she's shamed for committing, actually she emerges from it very well, but she's, in Vice's terms, she's shamed. It's a gotcha moment, and she's committed you know, the original sin of having intellectual curiosity and expressing an interesting opinion. Just on, so onto our final choice, which is Tim from you. It's a Times podcast, which I think is with Matt Chorley.
I am Mr. Podcast, really, aren't I? I will come out with some articles at some point. Yeah. And we should apologise if this is our final choice. None of us has picked Keir Starmer's essay, which is...
I'm still reading it. I'm still reading it.
Well, anyway, sorry, I shouldn't ridicule him. Actually, I'm... To the Times, the reason why I picked the Times podcast is for another reason, but I did actually hear before the piece that I've selected, Matt Chorley got, you know, one of those robot announcers that you can get to speak on the internet, words. He got one of those to do a read through of Keir Starmer's essay. And it was very unflattering, but it was incredibly funny. So actually, if you do go to what I'm about to recommend, which is Matt Chorley talking to BBC documentary maker Michael Cockerell, the Times Red Box podcast, you can actually hear the robot thing before the Cockerell interviews. But Cockerell has a book out, and he's interviewed all 12 prime ministers during his distinguished BBC career of the television age. And it sounds an amazing book, but this little podcast is just a lovely, quite moving history of his little soundbite insights into each of those prime ministers. And you get things like him meeting Macmillan, and Macmillan giving a talk, I think it was at the Oxford Union, where he remembered that he was the only person from his class of 20 to survive the First World War and the profound impact that that had on him as a politician. You had the first politicians of the television age, because you didn't have video recorders, they often weren't at home when their images were broadcast, absolutely mesmerised by looking at themselves on the television, because they'd never seen themselves and how they came across. And he said that impact on them was very powerful. Harold Wilson, who apparently before he became the avuncular prime minister that he was, didn't know how to tell jokes, but he studied JFK videos so that he could learn to humour. His pipe was an affectation. He actually smoked Havana cigars in private. And then finally, before I give away the whole of the podcast, was Margaret Thatcher, of course. She would always have a good story. And she used to, when Michael Cockerell used to arrive for an interview, she used to go up close to him and say, "Oh, Michael, your tie is marvellous." And it was very close, sorry for my Margaret Thatcher impersonation, but incredibly flirtatious, which of course is what she did use Maggie with the men that she engaged with. I think she quite preferred to be surrounded by men rather than women.
Yeah.
Have a favourite? Sorry, Ian. Did he have a favourite? Was he asked that?
I think he was asked that. I don't think he gave it away. I think he certainly had preference for some over others. I think Ted Heath and Gordon Brown were certainly not his favourite. He asked all of the prime ministers whether they ever had any doubts as to whether they were equipped for the top, to which Ted Heath said, no. That was another bad Ted Heath impersonation. And I think David Cameron said he had absolutely no doubts. Boris Johnson was sort of more actually engaging with that. It's a lovely, I think about, it's a podcast that goes about 40 minutes, about 20, 25 minutes into the Michael Cockerell section. I could have listened to it for an awful lot longer. And I do hope the BBC are going to make a documentary about the book in a way, because or an extended interview with him, because Cockerell did spend time with our prime ministers in a way very few other people didn't. It's a treasure trove of anecdote and information.
It's a really good choice, Tim. I love running into Michael Cockerell in and around Westminster. Obviously, it hasn't really been possible in the last couple of years with the pandemic. But I've had so many conversations with him down the years, just whether it's the quality of his insights. And you asked a question like, who are his favourites, Maggie? In that sense, I don't really... he's not coming from anywhere ideological. He just has a has a great gift for getting them to reveal themselves psychologically, or to highlight elements of their personality which reveal bigger truths about what they're like as people. And he has a sense of the ridiculous and the absurd. And he's one of the great chroniclers of the post-war age. Makes you know, fantastic documentaries.
The Reaction editors there with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is the Reaction Podcast. And until next week, thank you for listening.